what happens, and it's not entirely clear whether it's the egg or the chicken, but what happens when a patient has atopic dermatitis is that their skin microbiome loses this diversity, and Staphylococcus aureus just becomes super abundant. Its relative abundance goes sky high, and this totally correlates with flares.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series exploring the skin microbiome. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest advances in our understanding of the microbial communities of the skin, including progress towards clinical interventions in dermatology.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Deanne Tancredi.
And today's guest on the Science, Microbes and Health podcast is Dr. Maria Teresa Garcia Romero, who is a dermatologist based in Mexico City. So Maria Teresa, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we're absolutely fascinated to hear about your work, which, of course, is largely concerned, obviously, our dermatologists with the skin, but you specifically are interested in skin microbiome and in atopic dermatitis. What can you tell us? How did you get attracted to that? Most dermatologists, I guess, are not kind of wannabe microbiologists studying the bacteria on the skin. How did you get into the microbiome, the skin microbiome?
Well, that's a great question because it was an interesting path. So after I finished my dermatology residency here in Mexico, I went to do a pediatric dermatology fellowship in Toronto. And then I decided I wanted to, have more tools and knowledge to be a researcher when I came back to Mexico. So I went to the Harvard School of Public Health to get an MPH. And there I became friends with a gastroenterologist who was also starting to become interested about the microbiome, particularly the gut microbiome and, inflammatory bowel disease. And he invited me to a session with some people from MIT who were also interested in it. And, the first time I heard about it, I was just like, just mind blown. And I thought, of course, there must be so many skin diseases that are related to this. There's so many skin conditions that we know from a long time ago that you will, one, treat with antibiotics, even if they're not infectious. And that's because we're obviously modulating something, even if we weren't talking about microbiome back then. There's diseases that are inflammatory reactive, but there are associated with infections, so like a respiratory infection, and then you will get the skin disease, or a gastrointestinal infection, and that sort of triggers the skin disease, even if it doesn't seem to have anything to do with it. And so I just became fascinated by it. And as a result, several months after I came back to Mexico City, I went back to Boston at some point, and I met with a doctor from MIT. She works at both the Broad and MIT, Dr. Tammy Lieberman. And we started talking and we thought, we should study this. We should study how the skin microbiome is, is composed and is just like behaving in patients with atopic dermatitis. And she was also interested in going further. So our collaboration was, let's do sequencing, 16S sequencing, which is a part of the bacterial ribosomes. So you study that and then you don't get contamination from the skin cells and everything else that you will get from the swab samples. And then she went on to, with the same samples, we also studied how Staphylococcus aureus behaves. And so that was the beginning of that collaboration and the introduction, my introduction to this world. I mean, it's been, sometimes I talk about this and I say, now everything is the microbiome and patients are asking about the microbiome and probiotics and cosmetic stuff says it's got probiotics, which is obviously not true. But 10, 12 years ago, this was something nobody was talking about, like very few people were talking about.
Yeah, I can understand I think it has been overhyped. I think the microbiome is extremely important, but not as important as you would imagine from the number of papers and conferences and things that are being about it. But, and I can understand that Tammy would have been very infectious in terms of her enthusiasm for the microbiome. She's an outstanding scientist. What can you tell us? I mean, tell us what we know that the gut microbiome has hundreds of species, maybe even thousands of OTUs or taxonomic units, and that the more diverse, the better. And then we hear that the vaginal microbiome has very few species and the less diverse, the better. What's the story with the skin microbiome?
Okay, so the skin microbiome is also composed of, I don't even know, like probably hundreds, thousands of species, maybe more. And it's made up of bacteria, of course, which is what we usually think of when we talk about microbiome in general. But there's also fungi, there's also parasites that live in the skin, and there's also, of course, archaea and even viruses. Why not? So the virum. And in terms of the bacterial, well, all of this depend on where in the skin you're talking about, right? The face microbiome is completely different to the axillary microbiome or the flexural sites microbiome or between the toes of your feet, because they're completely different environments. But in general, I guess the accepted thing, you know, in general terms would be in skin, the more diverse, the better. Most of the bacteria that live in the skin are from the Staphylococcus, Streptococcus genera. That's genera, right? Yeah. But also in humid areas, we have all other kinds of stuff like Corynebacterium and Proteobacterium. But it would be a general severance to say the more diverse, the better, because when we lose that diversity is when we start seeing problems, at least in atopic dermatitis. So if we, Tammy, my team, but also a lot of other teams, have studied the skin microbiome in atopic dermatitis and what happens, and it's not entirely clear whether it's the egg or the chicken, but what happens when a patient has atopic dermatitis is that their skin microbiome loses this diversity and Staphylococcus aureus just becomes super abundant. Its relative abundance goes sky high, and this totally correlates with flares. And then after patients are treated, even if they're not given antibiotics, just treated with topical steroids, emollients, new biologics that we are using for atopic dermatitis, Staphylococcus aureus goes down again and the diversity flourishes again.
You've done some interesting work about one of the mainstays of treatment, which is empirical antibiotics. And you focused on how the susceptibility to the empiric treatment depends on the particular antibiotics, but also the region of the world. Can you talk to us about that work? A lot of us really worry about antibiotics being overused, but and also their effects on other bacteria, not the ones that are causing the problem.
Sure. So, after becoming interested in the whole microbiome and, finding the importance of Staphylococcus aureus and also living in a country where, people are taking antibiotics just really easily because they're so easily available. And there's this idea that if I don't take an antibiotic, I don't get better. I became interested in, what's going on with this bacteria that is causing atopic dermatitis or plays a role in the pathophysiology, and that patients who are constantly exposed to antibiotics, that has to impact the resistance of Staphylococcus aureus. So we started studying this. The pandemic started when we're about to start this project, which was meant to be done on the isolates of Staphylococcus aureus that we had from atopic dermatitis patients. So we decided to do some just more desk-oriented work while we could go back to the project. And so we did this systematic review focusing on the antibiotic resistance profiles of Staphylococcus aureus isolated from patients with atopic dermatitis. And we found very interesting things. So there is the widespread use of empirical treatment for patients with flares of atopic dermatitis. Like, we were all taught that, okay, if the patient is really, really badly flaring, an antibiotic can help. Obviously, if there's an associated infection, yes, we have to treat it. And these patients, since their skin barrier is compromised, they do have a higher risk of getting skin infections, even deep and even systemic infections. So we found that of the empirical recommended antibiotics, you know, by textbooks, by society guidelines, etc., a high proportion of those are Staphylococcus aureus is resistant to this in a high proportion. And we further try to study how, you know, being in a different type of country, and this was tricky because, you know, how can we divide countries, geographical region, or like how can we categorize patients? So we focused on the income, right? Because there's this idea that higher income countries have better systems in place to control widespread use of antibiotics, while lower income countries do not. But at the same time, higher income countries use more high-end antibiotics, while lower income countries don't because of the cost. And so we found some interesting things. So of the 61 studies that we included in this review, 4 of the 11 commonly used antibiotics had on suboptimal susceptibility rates. And suboptimal is something, you know, a kind of a construct that we took from other diseases, meaning that if you have an 85% susceptibility rate, then that's not good enough, right? Because you have
85% or lower is bad.
Or lower, right. That's not ideal to use empirically, including for methicillin, erythromycin, fusidic acid, which is used, you know, just widespread, and clindamycin, which is one of the treatments that we usually do for Staphylococcus aureus. And another interesting point is most of the studies that we were able to study, because they were published, come from high-income countries, right? So that speaks also of the disproportion and inequality of data that we have available, and especially lower-income countries do not have the infrastructure and the resources to, one, produce that data, capture it, and get it out there so it can be studied. So this was quite interesting. You know, this was sort of an unexpected study that we started, and it gave really interesting results. And I guess the main endpoint is you should always try to get culture data and sensitivity data before you treat patients. And also, we need to do better as a, you know, global community to get the data from all over, not just high-income countries.
And Rachel, so we see sometimes, or at least I listen to my gastroenterology colleagues, and they talk about, you know, a decrease in infection over the last century and mirrored by a rise in inflammatory diseases. And you're talking about, and, you know, sometimes, paradoxically, in low-income countries, you don't see these inflammatory diseases because you still have the infectious diseases.
Right.
Is atopic dermatitis regarded by dermatologists as an infection or an inflammatory disease? And how does it fit in that paradigm of the hygiene hypothesis and all of that kind of thing that goes on in the gut?
You're welcome to speculate here, because you may have more insights in this than just the prevailing wisdom.
And I mean, I will speculate, because I don't think we have the data to actually prove it other than epidemiological data, right? So atopic dermatitis is an inflammatory condition. It's not considered an infectious condition. But now that we have the access to sequencing and studying microbiome and, you know, deeply studying Staphylococcus aureus, certain, you know, phenotypic, genotypic characteristics, we know that this bacteria has a role in the pathophysiology of the disease, right? So almost all patients with atopic dermatitis are colonized in several skin sites by Staphylococcus aureus, much more than the general population without atopic dermatitis. We know, you know, the super antigens and certain, you know, characteristics or the virulence factors or survival, you know, kits that Staphylococcus aureus has, one decrease the natural antimicrobial molecules in the skin, so the antimicrobial peptides, two, stimulate the innate immune response, right? And three, very likely also keep the beneficial bacteria down. So Staph aureus comes and just like, you know, brings everything else down and becomes the alpha bacteria. So there certainly is, you know, that part of the pathophysiology that is related to an infectious and agent, which is Staphylococcus aureus, but it's 100% considered an inflammatory disease. And it is more prevalent in high-income countries, and it fits the hygiene hypothesis, right? One question is whether lower-income countries that have high rates of parasitic infections, maybe subclinical, you know, but we have all these parasites that we're constantly being confronted to, might help keep the Th2 inflammatory response stable, and thus you don't get these inflammatory diseases like atopic dermatitis. But those are conjectures because we actually don't know. So there may be genetic factors, you know, like higher income countries are more Caucasian, white people, and then lower income countries, it's other types of ethnicities and backgrounds. But also there is always a question of whether we have data from lower income countries, right? Like, are these patients being diagnosed and quantified, and is that data out there, or it's just not? And we think there aren't any patients, but we just haven't documented them.
I mean, certainly in the West and in more affluent societies, appearance is, of course, something that people are extremely concerned with and will seek support and help and from clinicians and from maybe suboptimal areas as well to, you know, to address any kind of a skin, poor appearance of the skin. Atopic dermatitis, it isn't just, I don't know, a reddening of the skin or something. Is it? Can you describe like how it manifests in an individual and the pain and discomfort it causes that individual? I mean, this is not a trivial condition.
For sure. And thank you for asking this, because I do think there's this general idea that skin diseases are, you know, mild, nobody dies from them. But people do die from them, and then people suffer enormously from them. So atopic dermatitis is very prevalent. 20 to 30% of the population, especially in children, will be affected by atopic dermatitis. And it's been proven to have a similar affection to the quality of life of patients as diabetes, renal disease, you know, conditions that we tend to think of really, really severe. So this might be associated to dryness of the skin and other allergic or atopic conditions such as rhinitis, asthma. And so patients begin by getting these red, scaly, itchy plaques that, of course, if you're itching, you're going to scratch. And the problem is scratching will make everything worse. And so these will start to disseminate, and imagine being itchy all day long. So children don't sleep, you know, they have neurodevelopmental involvement because they're not sleeping, they're falling asleep at school, they can't learn. The whole family becomes, you know, focused on why is she or he scratching, and why it becomes a huge family issue. Of course, psychology or mental health issues are much more prevalent in patients with atopic dermatitis and their relatives, their parents, their caregivers. And so it's just this completely dysfunctional life that patients have. And once you're able to, you know, get them controlled and even into remission and basically control this itching and help patients learn how they can take care of their skin and how they can stop this as soon as they can, patients' lives change. There's been a lot of studies recently because now that we have all these biologic drugs for atopic dermatitis, and we now have a few, which is great, there's been the, well, basically the interest and the resources to see what changes when patients go into remission of their disease. And all of those things that I mentioned improve, but also patients grow. So the growth chart just normalizes. So these patients are also, this inflammatory persistent condition also affects their growth, their bone density, like all kinds of paraclinical measurements. So it's a quite a severe disease. And last year it was included in the global burden of disease list by the World Health Organization, which was, you know, something that have been fought for a long time, and finally it was done, because it is one of the diseases that create a larger burden on patients, for sure.
Would you say that there's a myriad of treatment options, you know, but biologics and phototherapy even can be used, and empiric treatments? Are researchers doing a good job of characterizing the impacts of the therapies on the other skin microbiota, as not just the Staphylococcus aureus?
Right. I think since microbiome is, as you say, has become such a hype. Yeah, so there's been quite a few studies characterizing how the skin microbiome changes after you get these biologic drugs, after you get treatment with steroids or even with antibiotics. So I don't know. The question is, scientist's job, has it been good enough? It's a tricky question, because what's good enough, right?
Oh, yeah.
I certainly think that there's been a lot of studies more than 10 years ago. As I said, 10 years ago, we weren't even talking about this. We were, you know, just using bleach and using antibiotics, but we didn't really know what was going on. So it's much improved. I think there's still a lack of studies on what can we actually do to manipulate or modify the microbiome without having to take a biologic drug. So as trying to get remission, or at least maybe some patients will be improved and that will be enough without using other things. So the use of topical probiotics, oral probiotics. There's been quite a lot. And at least in Mexico, we now have two probiotics that are commercially available. And these are, they have really good data behind them. So for atopic dermatitis, preclinical, clinical studies. So I think that's been a great improvement, because...
And is the proposed mechanism of those, Maria Teresa, that they, I don't know, displace the Staphylococcus aureus or inhibit them? Or is it that they have anti-inflammatory characteristics? Are there any mechanistic kind of insights into how these might be working?
Yeah, so it's a mixture of both. So the gut microbiome in patients with atopic dermatitis has some differences with that of healthy controls. But the most important thing probably is that there is also an increased abundance of Staphylococcus aureus, so also in the gut. And these probiotics that have been studied and have, you know, have good data, maybe not huge clinical trials, because, you know, resources and permissions to do that size of clinical trials. So maybe not such huge, but the idea is that they sort of increase the production of short chain fatty acids by the gut bacteria, so by the other species. Decrease this increased abundance, relative abundance of Staphylococcus aureus, and that through the bloodstream will modulate the immune response. And so there's both mixtures of different strains and then also monostrains that have shown to decrease the atopic dermatitis severity. And, you know, both clinically, but also they've looked at cytokines and immune response markers. And so that's a big success to actually have this available, because even 5-6 years ago, when I would be talking about you know, probiotics might help. And people were like, well, but like which probiotics, right? Like it's not like take any probiotic. It needs to be a certain strain and a dose and blah, blah, blah. So at least here we do have that now. Topical probiotics, I think, are still a little bit farther in the landscape. Because I think, although there's been a lot of studies, I don't think there's been yet one particular mixture or strain that proves to be enough.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's probably more regulatory issues with, you know, selling a live bacteria.
And I've heard, and I've used it in lectures myself, so I hope I'm some way correct, that a lot of people, maybe even 40 or 50% of people, carry Staphylococcus aureus on their skin as a normal commensal part of their microbiome without showing any disease indications. But is it a predictor for likelihood of developing atopic dermatitis, or is that kind of commensal Staph aureus completely unconnected to the disease?
You know, that's a great question. I've never read anything that is trying to address that. Like, is this a risk factor? I'm trying to think about it because there's a lot of studies on neonatal skin microbiome, but I don't recall that finding, you know, that, okay. Oh, they have more Staph aureus, so they will get more atopic dermatitis, but maybe I'm wrong. The thing is, as I've gotten more and more into the Staphylococcus aureus world, and I have a team of bacteriologists that we've been working on some really interesting things that we never thought, at least I never thought, Staphylococcus aureus was capable of. So Staph aureus can internalize in epithelia, actually, you know, just like go in and stay there and then come back again. And that's been studied in respiratory epithelium, and I believe in endothelium of vessels, so patients with chronic endocarditis and stuff. But there's one recent study, and they managed to prove that it can also internalize in skin. So that's something that, you know, it's not the same to have Staph aureus, but what Staph aureus, right? Like what strain, what clonal complex, what abilities or virulence factors does that particular strain of Staph aureus have that lives in patients with atopic dermatitis? So, for example, one of the other studies that we did with Tammy, which was following how Staph aureus adapts in patients, we found something very interesting. And it was that two patients that suddenly one particular strain took over their whole body, this strain had a loss of the capsule, right? So does that make it more pathological or more, you know, more cause more problems?
Yeah.
Does it make Staph aureus hide from the immune response or maybe be able to internalize? So that's our next plan or step, is to try to study what exactly in Staph aureus is helping it damage more or cause more problems.
Thank you for sharing that, and the very best of luck. I mean, these are diseases that are badly in need of interventions and things that, you know, can make a difference to people's lives. It was fascinating to hear about the work you're doing, and thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org, and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.